There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable, available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey.
We've got an interesting episode today. We're going to be joined. I know this is a Supernatural News Parashare program on Saturdays, but we're going to be joined by a special guest in a few moments. But I've got to tell you, as we're going through our news feeds, always pulling interesting facts and news from around the world about the paranormal, one story has just infiltrated every news feed. And then I get away from my computer for a while, and I decide to sit down and relax and watch a little Netflix, Tim. Mm-hmm. And that story is front page on Netflix as well. There's no escaping that Unsolved Mysteries back. Yeah, July 1st. The relaunch of Unsolved Mysteries. Back in 1988, for those of you that are not old enough to remember, NBC began airing Unsolved Mysteries, which was a weekly TV series examining strange events behind cold cases and paranormal activity. The show was then transferred over to CBS in 97, then again picked up by Lifetime in 2001, repackaged by Spike in 2008, and then it is coming back to life right now. What draws people to this series? The intriguing stories, the dramatic reenactments, the opening, and the way that they open and share these interesting mysteries. And I think it's also the fact that they've always invited the audience to come along. And if you know more about this case, reach out. And those invitations, I think, is what really made people feel like this was a show that they were a part of just as much as what they were watching. Yep. Unsolved Mysteries is back with a complete reboot from the original creators, debuted on July 1st. And we're lucky enough today to have the director of quite a few of the episodes from season one of the new Netflix reboot series joining us today. And I got a chance to watch these episodes, Tim. First of all, I'm going to tell you one thing. I thought, oh boy, they're going to, you know, a lot of these shows have repackaged and they've used Robert Stack's original audio intros with new updated versions and things. And then I read there's no host, there's no tendon like that to the past. And I really was unsure of how I was going to feel about watching a show without Robert Stack or without having somebody in that role. And you know what? They have done such an amazing job with this, and watching it, I'm really thankful there is no host, because really, after Robert Stack, there's nobody that could fill that void and make it feel the way it did. Mm-hmm. It's like trying to reboot some of the other classics with, you know, without Rod Serling, without Alfred Hitchcock. It's just not the same show. And Stack had a really interesting vibe and feel to him. But this new series is shot in such a dynamic, cinematic way. First of all, beautiful filming. I mean, absolutely gorgeous. It doesn't feel like you're watching those old 1980s staged reenactments that were really cheesy. This is beautifully done, and they allow the experiencers to narrate and tell their story throughout the program. And again, they're focusing pretty heavily on cold cases, missing people, and there is a really fascinating episode in this series that boots it that I knew was going to be something that would intrigue our listeners. And obviously, we do a lot of true crime on this program with True Crime Tuesday and the paranormal. But when you talk about UFOs, Tim, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
You know, there are some key stories out there that always rise to the top, and you hear about them and they're intriguing and they're really great to kind of consider. But then there are some of these stories that just kind of seem to slip through the cracks. And I will be first to say I'm a little embarrassed. I didn't know this story, especially with how huge it is in the spectrum of ufology and possible alien abductions. The Berkshire's UFO episode, which I believe is episode 5 of the series, directed by Marcus Clark, our guest today. Marcus, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate being here. I'm looking forward to this. This is great.
I've got to ask you, I mean, in all honesty, why is this story not a bigger story? I mean, obviously there's a legend around it in that area, but this is one that just has not blown up the way a Roswell or yep. Betty and Barney Hill or any of these others have gone. Why do you think that is?
Interesting. You know, this particular incident, you know, it happened not only in 1969. These people were kids at the time. And so that being one factor, you know, people didn't feel comfortable really talking about it, which is kind of how we get into the episode. It was an unspoken event. For the most part, that people really didn't feel comfortable sharing and talking about without facing ridicule, without facing intense skepticism. So, you know, that in line with them being kids just made it something that I think was a slower burn in terms of the sharing of information and really people sharing their stories. I mean, you have to remember also these people didn't know each other at that time. So there's a lot of elements there. And the internet is not around. You know, this is a very different time period in terms of the sharing of information. So I just think that all of those different factors, and then plus them being at such young ages, really contributed to it just not getting the coverage. You know, the Berkshires is a very insulated type of community. It's a beautiful community, but it's very insulated. And so I just think it's one of those moments in history that just hasn't been exposed enough, and enough people haven't talked about it, enough witnesses haven't come forward for fear of being ridiculed or being called kooky or crazy. And I think, you know, in the UFO community, that's one of the things that is kind of the hardest obstacle to overcome if you're going to come out and actually share your story, you know.
Right. And what's a shame is that if this had been covered, imagine how huge this would have been at the time, because you had so many people each having these really life-altering experiences that are completely unaware of each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the story. And that it covered such a huge area. It wasn't just a one-off where, you know, Bubba Joe and his brother Ray are driving in a pickup truck in the back 40 and they see some lights and time goes missing. It's right. Not a one-off story. You've got multiple generations of families witnessing this. You've got mm-hmm. multiple people in different areas, and they're all having the same experience from what took place. I can only imagine, had that been allowed to spread, and it really has to make you wonder, if you dig into the conspiracy angle of all of this, was there a concerted effort to shut this down, dismiss mm-hmm. it, and keep it off the record books?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, something took place that night. Something happened to all these people. They all have, you know, while many of the stories are very similar and they recount similar details and similar experiences, they also have their nuances and they also have some differences in there, which I think lends to the credibility of the story. You know, it's hard to see the full picture of the puzzle without looking at each of the pieces. And I think, you know, for that community in particular, it's been kind of a challenge to uncover what really happened, because like I said, not all those people are friendly. Not all those people know each other. They aren't all on the same page. They're not like, you know, some group of people with similar interests. They, you know, in some cases don't even live near each other. You know, there's distance involved. And so when you hear all of the stories and start piecing together what happened and connecting the timeline of where this object was seen, of where it moved to, of who saw it next, you start to look at a much bigger picture of what was occurring that night. The other thing is a lot of people were in there. They were 10, 11, 12 years old. That's a bizarre phenomenon. That's a bizarre, you know, if this were a serial killer, we would be talking about, you know, that would make sense. But this, it's something that lends to some type of intent or some type of, you know, some type of, what's the word? Like, that's what they're, some type of intention towards what they were looking for or right. who was selected, so to speak. And so there's a lot of things like that you have to look at in order to put the whole picture together, you know, which I hope comes through in this episode.
Oh, it does. It's beautifully done. And I know, you know, the great part of this is the mystery of the episodes. We're not going to give much away specifically, but to kind of open it up, it's September 1st of 1969. Life is, you know, going about as it always does. People That's getting right. together, going to ice cream shops, family drives, playing at friends' houses. And then a mysterious set of circumstances begins. And I've got to tell you, I mean, there are different aspects of this story that I found really disturbing and chilling. You know, mm-hmm. you've got this young boy who suddenly feels telepathically drawn to go home immediately. And yes. the journey between his house or the house that he was visiting and his own home has got to be one of the most disturbing images and aspects of this story. When you mm-hmm. sit down and you're talking to these survivors, these experiencers, do you get at all from them that there's, you know, the series has always left it open, right? Is this real? Did this happen? And you can see this kind of haunted look in all of these people's eyes. But when you're sitting down with them, are you looking for a flag that might tip it off to you that, oh, this guy's just seeking some attention?
Well, yes, but not directly. You know, I've done this for a considerable amount of time in terms of conducting interviews and talking to people. So I do have a certain barometer for whether or not people are stretching things, whether or not people are becoming creative. You know, it's not foolproof, but it's part of the process. And so when I'm talking to them, I'm looking for those things subconsciously, subtly, but that is not the direction or the target of the interview. And so in that process, you know, I felt each of the guests were incredibly compelling, and not just compelling for their stories, but compelling for their characters. You know, some of them are upstanding members of the community. They're well known. They're local advocates. They're not kooks. They're not crazy people. They're not people off the beaten path. They're intelligent. They can tell their story. And then, you know, these interviews are extensive in length. And so throughout that process, I'm able to have all types of questions and things that are follow-up questions and highly detail-oriented questions in which their answers were just mind-boggling, like, you know, mind-boggling.
Right. Answers. When you're sitting there hearing this, now I want people to understand, too, that this, again, this isn't the just the imaginings of a 10-year-old boy running home and maybe something happened, maybe it didn't, maybe he tripped, knocked himself out and experienced. But there's eyewitnesses to what he claims was going on. And actually, his perception is completely different than what people are seeing him do. And mm-hmm. that was a really mind-bending moment in the episode as well. And like I said, this is one I don't want to give away, because when you hear it, it is so shocking, his claims, and that somebody witnessed what was happening.
Right.
What's it like for you to sit there in front of somebody as they unfold the story to you and you hear this? I mean, that's got to be strange alone. I mean, even though you've been in the business for a long time and, yeah. and know how to work with people, that's got to be a really kind of a life altering situation for you as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's fascinating, to be honest. You know, when I'm doing those interviews, we have eye contact the entire time, you know, and that's, you make this connection with the person you're talking to, you know, via that eye contact. And when they're telling their story, you know, I'm visualizing what's happening. You know, I'm immersing myself in that storytelling experience and trying to understand the elements. If somebody tells me they're running from one house to another, you know, there might be What do you remember about the run? Do you remember passing any landmarks? Do you remember anything you saw that night? And so he tells me about this rock, and the, I don't know if this comes through, but the significance of that rock is it's an area where they would play in their yard all the time. And so the fact that he had any kind of awareness of these small things that were going on around him, you know, it just creates a really compelling story and experience. And then it takes me to want to bring that to life through filmmaking as much as possible. How do we marry these interviews together and bring him to the location where this happened in a way where, you know, the viewers are just as compelled as I am when I'm sitting in that seat? You know, that's the connection I want them to have and the feeling I want them to have. Because these are really serious experiences that these people have had. It's also very difficult for them to talk about the nitty gritty details. And that's another thing, I think is important to come through. This was not a positive experience for these people. This is not something they cherish as a good thing. They're vocal about it. They're vocal about sharing their story, but this is not what you would call a positive story. This isn't the glory, so to speak. And so I think that's another factor you have to consider when you're listening to these stories. You know, I think you have to take that all of that into kind of consideration. But the passion is in their eyes. The trauma is also in their eyes. You can see that when you're talking to them. Some of that is in the episode, and there's even, you know, more things that I won't go into that are on the cutting room floor that is that trauma. You know what I mean? And so this is something that's very tangible and very real to these people that affected them and changed the trajectory of their lives.
How do you discern what you're going to include and not include? I mean, obviously, if it bleeds, it leads has always kind of been TV's, you know, tentpole, and seeing the emotion of what these people went through. Mm-hmm. Was it hard to select segments of the trauma to pull out without making it feel, and I'm guessing you did it so it didn't feel exploitative?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the biggest, that's one of the biggest things we are sensitive to. We take into consideration, you know, we don't want it to be exploitative. But we want the viewers to connect, you know, we want the viewers to understand and to see those moments so they can see the pain, they can feel the pain, or they can determine whether or not they even believe this person, which is also a factor, you know, because not all tears are real tears. You know, as we all know, there's that can be a move of deception in lots of different instances. And so that doesn't occur here. But, you know, it's something you have to be aware of. And then also, you know, when you say it bleeds, it leads. While that's true, you know, Unsolved Mysteries is a definitive brand. It's like a legacy brand. It's a legacy kind of true crime mystery show. It's the OG of mystery shows. And so while everybody's dancing to a certain tune right now, because true crime is, you know, one of the most popular genres in streaming, you know, there's some conventions we might want to avoid in order to make our, you know, mystery more engaging. You know, Bleeds It Leads works for horror, but it doesn't necessarily work if you want to suspend the audience and have them fully compelled throughout your story, you know, and trying to decode and figure out what's going on and put the pieces together. And so, you know, we take all of that into consideration, but we don't want to, you know, we have to think about how much emotionality is in the show. We have to think about how much emotionality is in the series, you know, because it's more, when you're talking about multiple episodes in a series, you don't want to just consistently run the gamut of emotionality, you know, throughout the whole. You have to have high points, you have to have low points, and you don't want too much of the same thing. You know what I mean? Every episode can't have everyone breaking down in tears. And so there's a little bit of a calculation there, but it's really nuanced. It's really about how we feel when we're watching it and making sure that there's still enough emotionality, but it's not overbearing and distract from the overall story. But I will say that it's hard to pick and choose with the details. It becomes very challenging, especially with a story like this, because you want to know all the details, right? You want to know, what did it look like? What did it feel like? How did it move? Like, but you can't necessarily in this format have every single detail, you know.
And
you
actually, I loved that aspect of this episode, that it felt very Jaws to me in nature. Mm-hmm. That yet the fleeting examples of what they're dealing with without being saturated in bad CGI UFO or something that, you know, takes you again out of that human element. I really cannot say enough that this is so beautifully shot. I hope this series lasts for the next 30 years because it's so beautifully done. And it brings you into the story as opposed to making you feel like a viewer. You're talking to these people and you're feeling what they're feeling. You're not feeling over hyped on any of this, but each one of these stories, and you've got quite a few families now. For what people don't realize is, as you said, this just wasn't something people talked about much at that time. There was many calls going of all places into a radio station. The radio station's the one that called the police. And even so, you look back in the records and there's very little officially on the books anywhere regarding this. Right. How do you start kicking stones and uncovering experiencers for a case like this?
Well, a tremendous amount of research goes into this type of an episode and this type of a show. A lot of it is vetting, to be quite honest with you. You have to talk to people. You have to talk to the community. You have to, you know, we were in touch with the Berkshire Anatheum. And you know, you have to do your research and you have to kind of go deep. At the same time, a lot of it is oral, you know, oral histories, people sharing information, you know, the old way, especially in these smaller towns. And so you might speak to one person who might lead you to someone else who might say, hey, you know, I know a guy who said he saw something, but doesn't like talking about it. And you follow that lead and you say, all right, well, who was the sheriff at that time? And okay, and he's no longer with us. He's passed on. Well, where's his son? And you know, you connect the dots, and you kind of follow down this rabbit hole, and you vet people, and you hear their stories, and you cross reference their stories, and you talk to them again, you know, a month or so later, and ask them similar questions or different questions. You really have to flush, you know, through the weeds, so to speak, to find your key, you know, storytellers for an event like this.
When these people come out, is there a lot of provocation to get them to open up, or you know, are they reluctant to share their stories again, especially 50 years later, or are they now all at points where no, this needs to be told, this needs to be heard?
I think most of our guests for Berkshire UFO are ready to talk, and they're ready to make sure their stories are told. I think some of them regret not making this a bigger thing earlier, but they were scared, and rightfully so. You know, scared of retribution, scared of being ostracized in their communities and made fun of, and you know, being an outcast and being different. And so, you know, I think the trauma kept them away from wanting to talk about it or share it. And their parents would say, "Oh, you're just making this up. You know, you're just being a kid. You're an imaginary friend is running around. Like this is." These are the kinds of things. And, you know, to be honest, I think that because of the subject matter of UFOs and where it kind of falls in, you know, in history and in our culture, there's not a willingness to record officially these types of events, whether that's for fear that you know, it should never be documented, or just people being in denial of these things occurring. You know, the Tom Jay, the radio station host who was receiving those calls from the research we've, you know, dug up was a skeptic, was a serious skeptic, to the point where even though he's receiving these calls and he's the one who called the cops, he was still a skeptic. You know, he told Jane Green, somebody he really knows and is familiar with, that it was swamp gas and that she was, you know, she was crazy that night. She just saw something else. So like, you know, when people are skeptics, I think it really works against getting to the crux and the truth of what happens in any event. And so I think that's only magnified when you're talking about UFOs and things that people can't explain, that seemingly have no explanation, but are very prominent, very visible. This would be impossible for people not to see and be, you know, recording or calling or, you know, having this experience, but it must have scared and shocked so many people that they just didn't want to come forward.
Were there other experiencers who would tell you things but refused to go on camera and share their story?
Not exactly. There were other people we had spoken to who do not currently appear in the episode. That's, you know, that there are more people, there are more witnesses. But again, there's a lot of things that we have to kind of factor in terms of how much information and how many people can be included in a certain, you know, in a certain length of time for screen time. You know, if I really into the subject, if I had it my way, it would be, you know, many episodes of UFOs so that we can really unpack this stuff. You know, one of the things I think is interesting is, you know, in the past, it's had this kind of, you know, it's been this untouched subject. It's been, you know, it's been taboo to talk about or to believe in or to think, report you seeing something. Today in 2020, that's very different. As we saw with last year with the Navy releasing the videos of the UFOs from the fighter jets, that was in the New York Times. You know, times have changed now. And so, yes, people should be talking about it and coming forward, but most importantly, there's less skepticism. You know, there's kind of an awakening happening right now in the country on many different levels. And I think that's one of them. And so I think, you know, we have to introduce this kind of information, you know, to the public, to mainstream, and then allow it to marinate so that we can go further and start getting into, well, what's actually happening here? What are these things doing? Why kids? Why just the kids? Because they're not going to remember. Because nobody will believe them. Is it strategic? Is there another biological reason for why it's kids? You know, let's unpack this. And I think now with this awakening is the time that we can have a more serious conversation about something that's been off the table for decades.
It's interesting as well, because, you know, obviously there's quite a bit said about the kids that had this experience and what happened to them, and two of them remembering seeing each other somewhere that was not of the area they were in. And I'll leave it with that. But obviously something happened to some of the adults as well, because, you know, there was a strange swap that happened in a car in one of the parts of the stories, which was beautiful that it happened that way, because it's so telling that the swap made it impossible to, gosh, it's so hard to not give stuff away, right? But the experiencers that are driving the car, somebody gets swapped in the front seat that should not have been there. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, everybody, you realize that there might have been more involved with the adults as well. But the children's aspects of the story are really compelling. And any one of these individual stories on their own is weird and, you know, worth a curious wink and a nod to. But when you start tying this narrative together and you see how far it stretched, how many people were affected by this, all in the span of one night, right? This was all during one evening.
Correct. One evening, September 1st, 1969. One evening, multiple locations, you know, spanning the Berkshires, Great Barrington, Sheffield area. You know, very, very intense experiences for the children, for the kids. It seemingly the adults, to what we know, just kind of passed out or unconscious, but the kids are having this experience that is more intense than the adults.
Is the following of these stories, again, you know, I mean, it, being the host of this show, immediately I'm like, God, go get a regression done. You know, these people have this missing time that's haunted them for 49, 50 years. Mm-hmm. Was there ever any thought of, I wonder if we should look at hypnosis on this? Or was it, again, is that one of those moments that then becomes kind of tabloid feeling and let's just keep it to the original narrative?
Well, here's what I'll say about that. Here's what I can say about that. We did look into that. Hypnosis was looked into. I obviously can't say who, and this did occur, and there are elements of that that we could not put in the show. That being said, I think that, you know, these subjects are so hard for people to digest. If they're not already interested in the subject matter, if they don't already, you know, critically think and have an open mind towards the subject matter, you can really lose people if you're going to talk about UFOs and hypnotism in a, simultaneously in an episode. I think while I think it's absolutely relevant and valid and has merit, it's just you have to kind of pick and choose where I want the audience to be. You know, I don't necessarily want to distract too far off the beaten path of the paranormal when I'm just trying to set up and take seriously, which is rare, this UFO phenomenon. You know, that was really important to me, to approach these guests seriously, professionally, in a mature manner, and treat the subject matter the same way, with integrity, with merit, break down what's happening here, ask them insightful questions, challenge them, but really present something as we do with all of the other mysteries. You know, people tend to, at least from what I'm seeing on Twitter, people tend to divide the UFO subject in quotation marks, but the mysterious deaths or the disappearances, you know, we treat as fact. I wanted to treat this episode with the same maturity and the same respect as those episodes, you know, so that it doesn't feel like, oh, all of a sudden this is the fake one. No. This is the real one. And everybody needs to know that.
It is, it's chilling. And I do like to, you know, the narration, I think if we would have had a Robert Stack in a, especially an episode like this, it might pull you back out instead of allowing you to just follow the experiencers and what they have happened. Now, at the end of the episode, of course, you know, you say, if you have any further information to what took place in the Berkshires, you know, contact us at unsolved.com. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know it just came out on July 1st, but you guys are trending number one in the U.S. Every page I look on social media, people are ranting and raving about the return of Unsolved Mysteries. Have you already started to get some new information in on that, or are you not at liberty to tell us yet?
I am not. It is very active. I am not at liberty to talk about that side of what goes on, but I do know it's very active, and there's a lot of people using the link. That's what I can say.
Do you believe that you'll revisit some of these stories in the future if there are updates? I know that they would do that on occasion on Unsolved Mysteries, or are there just so many damn stories out there you have to get to that it might be hard to go back and you know, reset into these locations with more aspects of the story?
Yeah. I mean, I'm very optimistic that there will be other details and clues and tips and maybe some content that doesn't appear in these episodes that might, you know, get released a little later on down the line. I'm not really sure, but I really hope that happens, because I think people are going to be very interested in some of the other details. And now, again, you know, the climate for this kind of content and the internet and Twitter being able to break things down and people becoming internet detectives, like, the world is very open for this type of material. And so I think right now, with the release that we just, you know, that we have just released, it's only the tip of the iceberg in terms of, you know, what information we can put out there and what clues and details can make an actual impact, you know, and can make a difference. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to more information and stuff coming out that people can connect and update with these episodes. But there is a second batch of episodes coming too. So that's a whole, there is another, you know, wave of episodes coming as well. So you can look forward to that too.
And I know we're here to discuss the UFO episode, and but you've directed some of the other episodes this season as well, looking at cold cases, missing person cases, some really strange stories that are definitely worth reexamining. Do you know from the original runs of this series, were there many of these cases that ended up getting solved through the help of viewership?
Oh, yeah. Unsolved Mysteries actually has a very long track record of getting cases solved, to be honest. I believe it's number two only to America's Most Wanted. Numerous cases have been closed, many after the fact, many years after the fact. And now that all of the, you know, all of the original episodes are available online, cases have been solved even since then, like even in more recent years. And so it's actually very effective in terms of, you know, shaking the trees for people to come forward and for clues to be put together. And to be honest, to put some enforcement agencies, you know, a little bit in the hot seat to do something and to motivate and to move, because cold cases, the unfortunate part is you have families behind those cold cases who've been devastated and who've been left tragically in bizarre circumstances with no answers. And that's just awful. And when you talk to those people, when you talk to those family members, it is awful. And what they have gone through is tragic and devastating. You know, to not have answers and to have lost a loved one in a gruesome type of manner or type of way is, I just can't even explain to you the pain that these people go through. And so if it moves the needle in that direction, you know, I think it's positive, and it's really, these people are very grateful and they're thankful that, you know, we get to elevate their stories and put it forward and, you know, let the world kind of decide, let the world handle it, deal with it. You know, a lot of these cases, like the Alonzo Brooks case, you know, it needs national attention. It requires national attention in order to get solved. Unfortunately, in that situation, there just seemingly is no incentive to solve that case. Now there is. Now things are changing. The FBI has reopened his case. They put a $100,000 reward for any information that leads to, you know, to arresting someone, to a conviction. And so that's really powerful. And that's a big incentive to motivate people, particularly, you know, respectfully in the South and in these small towns. $100,000 goes a long way. So hopefully that can, you know, help the family and help them get answers. And
some I'll tell you what. I live in Minnesota. Up in the north, $100,000 goes a long way too. So
yeah, I mean, $100,000 goes a long way pretty much anywhere. I'm just saying, like, you know, that is a legitimate incentive to do the right thing, you know. And in situations like that, somebody knows. Somebody's living with guilt on their conscience. Somebody's wife is living with guilt on their conscience. Somebody's kid is living with guilt on their conscience. There's some people who know what happened here. You know, this didn't happen in a bubble or in a vacuum. Alonzo Brooks's case and his story is not something that could have happened in a one-on-one fight with somebody. You know, and so there's multiple entities that have to have contributed to what happened to him. And in a place where there's only X amount of residents, you know, it's unfathomable that they can't figure this out, or that there's no leads. There's no information. There's no leads. You know what I mean? That's a problem. That's a real problem.
It really is. Do you think when exposing stories like this, and again, going to the UFO and the Berkshires story, do you think that this is going to lead to the fact that we're going to find out that this map has been stretched considerably from where the sightings have most highly been concentrated and the experiences? And do we also have, I know the listeners will go nuts about this, do we have a timeline of this being maybe one craft that's going and picking people up, or are we thinking that there's multiple craft?
That, my friend, is a very, very good question. I do think the timeline will expand. I think the map will expand if more people come forward and feel comfortable. What I think is the most important revelation from interacting with all of these people and getting all of their intimate stories and all of the nitty-gritty details is they all saw the same event, but they did not all see the same craft. And that's really, really important. I think it could be made a little bit more clear in the actual episode, but what one describes and what the other describes are very similar, but they're seeing different things. And so Tom Werner, for instance, he sees one craft. One craft engages with him. He describes it. I'm not going to reveal all the details. Tom Reed, what he describes is multiple crafts. Okay. So in my opinion, I think three of them saw the same object. And then Tom Reed saw a fuller picture, which included multiple objects, one particular object with one, you know, shape, size, and dimension, and smaller objects that he also describes, on the other side of his vehicle. And so he's kind of being inundated, and he has the most witnesses. Okay. It's him, it's his brother, it's his mother and his grandmother, all in the car. And so he's seeing multiple things happening. And our other guests are all being engaged by one craft. So Jane Green's story, she describes one specific craft. Her description is most similar to Tom Warner's description. It's just, I think over the timeline, they're seeing an event happen, one larger craft and then smaller crafts also peppering that entire area. And that's really an important detail. And that's a detail that they don't know. And that's that. This is what I'm saying. When you talk about the puzzle pieces of a story, it's important for people to know, especially when you're talking about events that multiple people engage with. It is impossible to see the whole event from one person's perspective. It's like, you know, it's like any crime or situation. If you see somebody get hit by a car, you're on one side of the street, I'm on the other side of the street. I see one thing, you see another thing. The passenger experience is a whole different thing. The helicopter sees everything. You know what I'm saying? Like, the helicopter sees the whole picture. And so that's the kind of way that you need to put the puzzle together to understand what happened. I think they saw multiple crafts were out that night. Multiple crafts were engaging with people, doing different things. Who knows? And that's what you get when you put all the different stories together and all the different pieces. And to me, as a filmmaker, that makes the storytelling and the event not only more credible, but way far more compelling than just saying, hey, I saw this weird object outside, you know, and then you talk to your neighbor and they're like, well, I saw an object and it was next to another object. And you see somebody down the road and they saw an object, but it was low and it was flying somewhere else. Like, they're all seeing the same event, but not necessarily right. The same object.
And they're getting it from different vantage points, which may give them a version. If something's directly over you, you're not seeing the peripheral to see what else might be in the skies at that point.
Now, exactly. And these moments are very, you know, they captivate your attention. This is something you've never seen before. So,
right.
You know, you're going to be fixated on one thing or another thing. You know, it's just one of those.
This series, like you said, they're going to be releasing more of the episodes. This is the first in this batch that has kind of this paranormal feel to it, otherworldly feel. Most are these true crime. Are we going to see more of the paranormal interwoven through the series as it progresses as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The next batch will have some paranormal as well. You know, the paranormal subject matter, paranormal activity, everything in that category has always been a big part of the Unsolved Mysteries brand, big part of what the show is, what the audience is, you know, what the viewers are into. This is that subject matter. It's missing persons, but there's a huge demographic of people who want to hear about the paranormal, and Unsolved from the early 90s to the present has been that program that presents those cases, goes deep into those cases, and takes them serious. And I think there's a lot of people in the world who are looking for that, because it's just so hard to make those kinds of shows and films and make them compelling and have people view them and take them seriously. And so that being such an important part of the brand's DNA, it's going to be with us. And so definitely in the next round, there are some paranormal stories in there.
Marcus, thank you so much for joining us and giving some insights. It is great to see Unsolved Mysteries back. I'm happy to see it's in the hands of capable directors, writers, and story researchers, because this, and again, having watched all the episodes in this first batch, it has blown me away with the storytelling, the filming, everything. I hope you guys keep up this high standard, and we look forward to talking to you on the 5th and 10th anniversary of this series on Netflix.
Absolutely, man. And thank you. And thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it. I love you guys' podcasts and I like what you're doing. And I'm glad you're putting a spotlight on the show. So thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, folks. It's out. It's available on Netflix. It started on July 1st. And hopefully we'll continue for a good long time. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We've got more of the best in paranormal talk radio, more supernatural news, and your encounters when we return to Darkness Radio.
Hey, 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 this is NFL Hall of Famer Ray Lewis. I'm excited to announce the launch of my new podcast, Everyday Greatness, the Ray Lewis Podcast. I'll be talking with friends, family members, old teammates, athletes, celebrities, moguls, and guess what? I'll be talking to you. Listen, this is all in the search for everyday greatness. So I'm asking you to come along with me on this ride. Download new episodes of Everyday Greatness, the Ray Lewis Podcast, every Friday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on podcastone.com. It's not what you have, it's what's inside of you that actually inspires greatness.
We're back. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. And seriously, folks, check out Unsolved Mysteries Reboot on Netflix. Tim, this is such a good series. I really do hope if they keep it the way it's going that time. And, you know, the stories kind of vary in length. This story, like a 39-minute power punch. It's so well done. I think if we'd had another minute of it, you might have started to, I don't even know, disconnect from the story. You know, it left me wanting more, and I really do hope they update it with more aspects and more people that might come forward that are finally willing to share their memories of that, that experience.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so last week we talked about Kevin Bacon.
Yes.
And his forays into the horror world, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
And as if the horror gods themselves and Kevin Bacon hurt us, new news springs out. Are you ready for this?
I think I am. Has he extended his foray into the horror genre?
It appears he might be ready to. Last summer, Robert Englund said he would like to see Kevin Bacon take over the role as Freddy Krueger in a new Nightmare on Elm Street.
Okay.
And just the other day, Bacon told his buddies over at Bloody Disgusting website that he's up for the role. He says, sure, it would take a lot of makeup, but I'd do it. Englund said last summer he's not a kid anymore either, but the rumor I've heard that I like is Kevin Bacon. Kevin loves horror. He's a real actor. He's a character actor. Kevin was great in Tremors. Kevin was great in Stir of Echoes, and I've heard this rumor.
Huh.
Yeah. So I'd love to see it. I don't know what your thoughts are on it. You know, and again, first of all, do I want to see another reboot of Nightmare? They did one with that Jackie Earle Haley, and it didn't do well at all.
Right.
First of all, there was just something missing from his portrayal of Freddy, and I don't necessarily blame him. I blame the directors on that when they just can't seem to figure out a way to capture it. But the original is so phenomenal. If there was somebody that could pull it off, I could see it being Kevin Bacon. And here's an example why. If you see his new movie, You Should Have Left, that we talked about last week.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He plays, I don't want to say dual characters, but there's this creepy, skinny guy with a ball cap on and kind of raspier voice. And he's this, you know, he looks like your everyday common janitor guy or maintenance guy working in the schoolyard, right? But he just plays it with this creepy vibe and look. And I just, if you threw a fedora on him and a red and green striped sweater,
mm-hmm.
you've got Freddy Krueger.
Hmm.
So I think if anybody could pull it off and make it interesting, it's Kevin. Because let's face it, everything's better with Bacon, Tim.
That is true. However, Dave, I think I'm with it until the big dance finale at the end of the movie. And then after that, I'm lost. I think I'd throw it out.
You're ridiculous. Who wouldn't want to see Freddy in the dark down in the basement start jamming?
Me.
I need a hero. I need a hero. No, you don't see him running around, throwing his head back and popping the claws?
No. I think I'm done at that point.
Hi, Tim and Dave. That's how this letter starts. Oh, yes, I did.
Hiya.
She puts.
Yeah, you did.
Piff off and talk, Tim. Suddenly mm-hmm. I'm channeling my inner Arthur.
Uh-huh.
People often talk about Ouija boards in a negative way, but I wanted to share a couple of positive Ouija stories, as these unique boards have always been around me. My mom has had a special connection to connection to her Ouija board ever since it chose her. That's right, my mom's board
chose her.
Hmm.
Now I'll forgive Dahlia for mentioning you first because she's obviously touched in the head, Tim.
What?
Mom's board chose her. Come on. Crazy. Cuckoo, cuckoo.
I believe
it's the only way. That's the only explanation for why she would start the letter off "Hi, Tim and Dave" and then rub my nose in it. Crazy.
No.
Crazy.
No.
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 No. All right. My mom attended a gathering at a friend's house in the 1960s. One of her friends had brought their Ouija board with them because what could be more entertaining than having a portal into the unknown and possible demon dimensions? Am I right?
Yep.
She's crazy, Tim.
No,
crazy.
That was a good joke. That was
throughout the night, my mom watched from across the room as different groups took turns sitting at the board, the planchette, asking questions. She was skeptical of the thing, so she started to think up questions in her mind while people were using the board. Then an odd thing happened. The board started answering her questions instead of the ones being asked by the people at the planchette. When there was confusion about what was happening with the answers, my mom confessed she was asking the board her own questions, and those were the ones being answered. Mm-hmm. At the end of the night, the friend who had brought the Ouija board gave it to my mom and said, "You should have this. It's obviously your board."
Interesting.
And she's had it ever since. Huh. And that's how every horror movie starts, Tim.
Well...
The Ouija has called to her.
Mm-hmm.
My mom doesn't use the board for fortune telling or as a game. She usually only pulls it out when the board calls to her.
Hey, Martha! Martha! What'd you forget about me?
So, Gilbert Gottfried is the board, a voice of the board?
No.
Oh. Okay.
Well, that was obviously the planchette, Tim. Everybody knows a Ouija board.
Sounds like this.
Oh,
hey, Martha.
It's Ralph the dog.
Grab old Planchy and me and let's get moving.
Yeah, I've got two in my repertoire. Okay. I've got to just get used to it. Ralph the dog and Gilbert Gottfried.
Okay. All right.
The Ouija board calls to my mother. Whenever the board has a message for her, it will gently shake her bed at night. And this is something I have witnessed myself on more than one occasion. It's the weirdest freaking thing. I'm not going to lie, but my mom just takes it in stride. The Ouija or the messages she receives are from and or about people who have passed, including messages for living people she knows from their loved ones who died. Sometimes the messages are warnings for or about people, too. There are many, oh, so many stories about my mom and the paranormal. Superstitiously speaking, she is the seventh child of a seventh child and was born with the call over her face. That's the placenta, I think it is, over their face. Is that right?
Oh, I was going to say, I know it ain't a prince's hat with the veil. I know that much.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Although it'd be a lot easier to clean.
It would be. Yeah.
In some cultures, it's believed both of these conditions bless the people with magical powers and a second sight, respectively. It's called being born with the veil over your face, right? And she does have gifts. My mom has always had an interest in the paranormal, and that interest was passed on to me. When I was growing up, there was always books, different tools, and divining, such as pendulums and tarot cards, and there's always been a Ouija board.
Hmm.
Now, when I was about 13 or 14, my mom got me my own board. I can hear the gasps, the pearl clutching, and the tapping of the keyboards already. Before people start freaking out about this, you should understand a few things. To begin with, I am that person who, if you try to keep something away from me, then I must get to it. Especially when I was younger. I was like a ferret always nosing into things. Well, then let me say this. Tim's first digits of his phone number are 612.
Dave.
Well, I just want to see if she's willing to dig deep and find the rest, Tim.
But see, Dave, if you give it out on the air, you give it to everybody. You can just send it private.
No, she's the one listening to me. She can hear me specifically.
Dave, we're on the air.
Oh.
Yeah.
I am that person who, if you try to keep something away from me, like Tim's phone number, 612-4...
Dave,
I must get to it, especially when I was younger. I was like a ferret always nosing into things. Next, my parents both worked, and there were several hours a day when I was home, alone. I could get my hands on the board if I were set on doing so. Yes, she could have gotten rid of the board, but why should she have to? She was an adult who was entitled to have her own things, and I was a child who needed to learn that this item wasn't a game to be played. She decided it was better to get me my own board, set the rules, and teach me how to use the board to keep me as safe as she could. The first rule set, which I admittedly broke, but only once, and I'll tell you about that in a moment, was that I couldn't use it without asking her. The next rule was that I needed to set proper intentions before using the board. After that came the no jerk rule.
So Steve Martin wasn't involved at all in any of this?
He's never allowed to investigate.
Oh.
I had to be mature and respectful to anyone who came through the board, but I had to stick with my boundaries. Finally, and this was the most important rule, I couldn't feed it after midnight. Wait, no. The most important rule was to only use the board when my mom was home. So basically, I could never use it by myself without my mom knowing. Again, I broke this rule, but only once. There were other guidelines that I will share at the end of my story. Okay. The one time I broke the rules of not asking permission and using the board when I was home alone made me realize the relationship my mom has with Ouija boards. As I said, I was a latchkey kid and spent most of the time home alone after school. One day, I decided to mess around. There's just no better way to describe it. With my Ouija board without asking mom. I pulled it out of the closet, took it to the front room. I sat down on the couch and opened the box. I removed the board, set it on my lap, and pulled out the planchette. I set my intentions and I put my fingers on the planchette and asked, "Is anybody here?" The reply was, "Nothing." Nothing happened. The planchette didn't move. I stretched my fingers, I placed them back on the planchette and moved it around a little to make sure that I wasn't putting too much pressure on it and holding it down, preventing whatever entity was on the other side from talking to me. "Is anybody there?" And then, nothing. "What the hell, Ouija?" I kept trying it for another 15 minutes and then got frustrated to the point that I slammed the planchette down on the couch and flung the board across the room. Being made of cardboard but sort of heavy, it just landed on the floor and slid silently across the carpet. Then it stopped in the middle of the floor. It didn't hit anything. I stomped off to my room. After calming down, I went back and picked everything up, returning it to the closet. Done. I didn't tell anyone about that incident. About a month later, I decided to pull the board back out. My mom was home, so I asked her if I could use the board. She said, "Sure, just don't throw it again." Ooh. The board knows, Tim.
No.
The comment then goes to, "Holy beep balls." I was shocked. I looked at her for a moment and slowly asked, "How did you know I threw it?" She looked at me and said, "Sweetie, it told me." I want to point out again, there was no damage to the board. Beyond that, there was no reason for her to pull my board out or to even see damage if there had been any. There were no hidden cameras in our house and absolutely no way she could have known about the incident without someone or something telling her. I still have my board, and I never broke those rules again. Although as an adult, I don't need my mom's permission, and I haven't respected my board since. But I will admit, I did make mistakes with the board. And there are some dark, but ultimately harmless stories that I will share. Yes, at another time.
Ah!
Mistakes happen not because of what I did, but because other people in my life didn't follow the rules. See, Tim? She's crazy.
No.
She gives us the old, "Oh, I'll tell you this story another time."
No, that's just, you know, the story tease.
It's horrible. No. If you want to know some more of the rules and guidelines she provided, here they are.
Okay.
Oh, we do want to know. We'll share them another time.
No, come on.
Always invite the light in with good intention. You could say or think something like, "If you come in light and goodness, you are welcome. Be curious, be kind, keep your intentions good," she says. The board isn't a game. Don't use it when you're impaired, sleepy, sad, or upset. Well, that pretty much gets rid of my entire day. When I'm not impaired, I'm usually sleepy, sad, or upset, Tim.
Yeah.
The board shouldn't be scary. If you do get scared, reset the connection and tell whatever you're talking to they aren't welcome. Refocus on your good intention. Don't be a jerk. Don't be sarcastic or taunting of anything that comes through the board. Simply reset the connection and move on. You know what, Tim? I'm going to try that right now.
Okay.
I'm setting my intention. Mm-hmm. I've got my board here.
Okay.
All right?
All right.
Got my planchette. You can hear it as I put it on the board. Mm-hmm. Did you hear that?
Okay.
Okay. Let me just... Can you hear it going?
Yep.
All right. Ready? Okay. O spirits, I come to you in respect. If you could please, please only communicate with me with positive messages, messages that must be given to the world. This is your time to shine. What message do you have for me to share with the world? Ooh, Tim, the planchette's moving.
Oh.
It says T.
Yeah.
I.
Uh-huh.
M.
That's me, Tim.
Wait, it's moving.
Okay.
Now it says six.
Six?
One. Like
six, one.
Two.
Hey, no, that's my phone number. No, Ouija board. Bad Ouija board. Reset the connection.
You're being a jerk, Tim. You're being a jerk. Remember, she said no jerks. If the Ouija board has a message to tell, Tim, we have to let the world know.
No.
It's six,
no,
one,
no, no, two, no, no, no. Bad four, Ouija. No. Reset the connection.
Man.
The Ouija board's being a jerk.
Good God. Be skeptical of everything. That's another one.
Yeah, I am.
Don't ask how people died. In my mom's opinion, it's rude and not really important to the spirit anymore. Don't anticipate answers or letters, as this can influence what you come across. If it sounds perfect, it's probably not true.
Exactly.
Some things will tell you whatever you want to hear to keep you engaged. Reset the connection and or walk away. If you keep getting drawn to the board, stop using it. Nothing can tell you all the answers and predict everything. Life happens. Just live it. That's all I have for now. Thank you guys for all the care you give to your listeners, especially you, Tim. Sincerely, thank you. Cheers, D. Whatever, D.
Oh, thanks, D.
You sure you don't want me to keep using my... I mean, got my planchette.
No, that's right fine. Here, Tim, I think you've used it enough today. No, you're good.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
All right, fine.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Dave. I love listening to your podcast, and on one of your stories caught my attention. So now I want to know if you can ask one of your psychics or spiritual persons if they have a prayer for generational curses that one might have from the past. Thank you, Sandy. Oh, she really addressed me in that from her iPhone. That must be a double slam to you, Tim, because you keep trying to get me to go to iPhone and I stay with Android. And she wrote to me on her iPhone and only to me. In your face, Delia. That's what I have to say to the last one who addressed you first. No, you know what? The prayer of St. Michael the Archangel is always a very powerful, protective prayer. As far as generational curses, I'm not sure. But next time, Tim, next time we have somebody on dealing with that, let's definitely ask if there is a known prayer. So you'll just have to tune in next time for the answer on that. I know that sucks, but I don't have an answer right now. I'm sorry. All right, Tim. Mm-hmm. Do you want to own a castle?
Own a castle? Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's one for sale, Tim. It's up for auction right now. Are you ready for this? You got to head off to Kansas City, Missouri, Tim.
Oh, that's not too far away. That's 8 hours away. Yeah.
Yeah. So you have to move from your current address at 314.
Yeah, Dave. People
well, I'm just trying to, so MapQuest people can see really how far it is, Tim, if they know just, your address and know you're moving to Kansas City.
I just told them, Dave, 8 hours away. They don't need to know any more than that.
Well, they might be trying to convert for Canadian time, Tim.
Still 8 hours in Canada, Dave. Oh. Yeah.
Well, Germany?
Still 8 hours in Germany, Dave. Yeah.
What about down by the Texas border, Tim?
Yeah, time, although it feels like it stands still in Texas, still only 8 hours. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. You learn something new every day. Yeah. Sour Castle in Kansas City, Kansas is up for auction, according to a posting on the Unified Government's website. The estate located at 935 Shawnee Road, which I'm looking here, Tim, is exactly 8 hours away from 314.
No, Dave.
What? No. Well, I'm just clarifying. You were right. I wanted to give people, you know, the idea that they could see this.
Just confirm that I was right. It was 8 hours away. Yeah.
Well, the estate is a KCK landmark, Kansas City, Kansas, Tim, landmark.
Yeah.
It's on the National Register of Historic Places. Anton Philip Sauer, a German immigrant who came to Kansas City in the 1860s, built the home and lived there with his five daughters, wife, and her children. Five generations of the Sauer family lived in the home, which sits on a 2.85-acre lot. Now vacant, the castle is surrounded by chain-link fencing with no trespassing signs. It's long drawn attention because it's incredibly haunted, Tim. Some people report seeing lights in the watchtower as well as a figure standing and walking in front of the windows. It's a cool. I want to own a castle, Tim. I'm just saying. My 53rd birthday is coming up in November.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to do something nice for me, get me a castle in Kansas City, Kansas.
I'm sure.
Thanks. Great. You heard him here, folks. That's a legal, binding, verbal contractual agreement.
They don't come with any creature comforts, you know. They don't come with Wi-Fi or electricity or anything like that.
No, but ghosts, and that's pretty big. I'll take ghosts.
Okay.
Hey, speaking of ghosts, Netflix is on a roll, Tim, because they're dropping a scary Grudge prequel series called Yuan Origins. The Grudge, a successful horror movie franchise, is getting a prequel series on Netflix called Yuan Origins. A six-episode series begins streaming right now, Tim.
Right now?
How about that? Netflix describes it as a paranormal researcher searches obsessively for a cursed home where something terrible happened to a mother and her child long ago. Set in Tokyo, the series exposes the dark, brutal forces in humanity, which includes supernatural elements. The cast stars, of course, Yoshiyasu Arakawa, Yuina Kuroshima, and Kana Karashina.
Way to stick
written
in.
By Roshi and Takahashi and Takashigi Ikishi.
Nice.
Shou Miyake from And Your Bird Can Sing directs the violent, suspenseful prequel. Tim, it's a prequel.
That's the one tripped on.
That's the word. I get through all of that, and then I screw up on the prequel, which follows various characters via multiple timelines. They're all connected by the cursed house. The franchise totals 13 films. 9 are Japanese, 4 are American. The first Hollywood movie, The Grudge, directed by Sam Raimi. The brand has also inspired several novels, comics, and video games. Per Netflix, the horror classic franchise Yuan has actually based on real events that occurred over 4 decades, and the truth is even more terrifying. Can the people haunted by this house escape from its curse? And what kind of grim incident occurred in this cursed house in the past? Other Japanese dramas released by the streamer include The Followers and The Forest of Love, Deep Cut. How about that?
Interesting indeed. Yeah.
Huh? Yeah. So there you go, a prequel to The Grudge. All right, now here's a story from another country, Tim.
Okay.
So it's one of those poorly made, it's from India, it's one of those poorly translated articles.
Oh, I like these, yeah.
Should I read them as they are poorly translated, or should I try to punch it up, or just give it to you as written?
Give it to me as written.
Give it to me, baby. All right, here it goes, Tim.
Okay.
Do you love ghost stories? Reading through the creepy tales of supernatural stuff or paranormal activities? Then we have a story of Rose from Gurugan for you. A girl so mysterious that her disappearance traumatized people working with her. We tell you the story of Rose from the infamous Saffron BPO in Gurugan. Imagine discovering that you have been working with a ghost all along. No, we didn't mean it in a funny way, but finding out that the girl you've been working with all the while doesn't exist and is dead. Hmm. Creepy much? Well, that's what this real ghost anecdote states, Tim.
Yep.
That's the one word that they didn't mess up. I'm
an anecdote.
Anecdote. The Tale of Rose is going to be made into a movie titled Rosie, the Saffron Chapter. And if that's got you curious about her story, read on. Rose, a hardworking employee in Gergerum's Saffron BPO, now the BPO, stands atop a graveyard. That's no comforting start. A girl so good at her job, she would always meet her targets and bag the Employee of the Month title consistently. Her punctuality and consistently meeting her targets made her an inspiration for many. But behind Rose's hard work was an intriguing secret that not many knew. Once while working, Rose got an inbound call, which went on for more than an hour, Tim.
Whoa.
Yeah. A phone call at work that lasted more than an hour. This story is chilling.
I mean, I've done some stuff at work for more than an hour, but never a phone call.
Her team leader just barged in the call to check, see if anyone needed any support, but found that there was no one on other line.
Oh.
After this day, Rose disappeared. Uh-oh. She went on unprecedented leave. Now, a most hardworking employee suddenly not turning up is fishy. So her employers managed to trace her address via transportation details. The first shock came in when they managed to speak to Rose's landlord. He claimed that no such girl lived there. Even the neighbors confirmed there was no girl like Rose staying around. As skepticism grew about Rose, the employers decide to trace family. It wasn't easy to contact them as Rose didn't share with much anyone.
Then what happened, Kimo Sabe?
But when they finally made through, there were in for a shock.
Ah.
I'm reading it as written.
Yep.
The family informed that Rose died 8 years ago. The news freaked out the colleague so much that Rose's best friend from work is said to have died after a cardiac arrest. Several of people who work closely with Rose were also mentally unstable as they couldn't believe it. A lot of people quit jobs from call center after this incident. The mystery about Rose, the dead girl living, stays on. Whose call was it? Did Rose return back to her grave? Did she have some purpose? God, I'm trying to cram F's in where they don't belong today. Did she have some purpose in the BFEO center? The questions about her remain unanswered. We do not know if it is actually true, but it has been cited as a real event in the Gergerum from years ago. That'd be creepy. You work with somebody. You know what would be weird is because of this whole COVID crisis?
Yeah.
What if you found out that when this is all over and we're finally able to work in the same studio again,
mm-hmm.
that I've been dead the whole time?
And you just float in here, do your stuff, and float out?
I'm committed to my job. That's faux show.
That is commitment, yeah.
Yeah. I should be committed. You always tell me that.
Well, you know, I'm just speaking truth.
Our final story of the paranormal ilk is about Ghostbusters investigating a foul-mouthed ghost.
Really?
Our favorite type. Yeah.
Yeah. Gotta love them.
Yeah. Yeah. Amateur paranormal investigators Christine and Dave Thomas revealed that while investigating a site in Somerset, they heard a ghost rudely telling them to leave. The area is popular for the scenic hills. Locals of Somerset shared their paranormal encounters in the area, and the couple claims that there are more than one spirits haunting this popular spot. Christine and Dave went to investigate the area known as Dead Woman's Ditch on the Quantock Hills in Somerset. While there, Dave reportedly picked up a faint voice. Soon after he heard the voice, his wife received a clearer message. Christine reportedly heard the rude ghost shout, "F off!" The rude message to leave was loud and clear, according to the couple. Dead Woman's Ditch, which is a horribly named place, is associated with the murder of Jane Walford. Her husband, John Walford, had murdered her and left her body there in 1789. Boy, talk about never being able to give up a bad nickname.
Yeah.
17. We're talking almost 300 years. However, the name of the place predates the murder of this woman. what? So it's kind of like it was named Dead Woman Ditch, and somebody figured, well, since it's already named that, I'm just going to put one in there? That's crazy.
Yeah.
Now, John was reportedly hanged nearby when he was found to be guilty of the murder of his wife back in 1987, though, Tim. Almost 202 years, 29-year-old Shirley Banks was found murdered near Dead Woman's Ditch. John Kanan was convicted for the murder in 1988. The spirit swearing at people is known as the Woman in White. Multiple people in Somerset reportedly have had encounters with a woman dressed in white. That's why she's named the Woman in White, Tim, just in case there was any confusion. According to Bristol Live, a resident of the area had a paranormal encounter on the road when they were 17. The person wrote that they were driving down the road when they saw a woman dressed in white, old-fashioned clothing. They continued to drive past the figure, but were too terrified to look back after they'd driven past her. Dave claims that paranormal voices are of two kinds. One kind of voice is from a residual memory, which keeps repeating. These kind of voices that people pick up on cannot be interacted with. The other kind of voice is one that can be interacted with. These voices are not heard by most people. He stated that not everyone can detect ghosts. People with weak barriers are more likely to perceive the paranormal. Dave and Christine share their stories and investigations on their Ghost Hunters South website. But them apples, Tim. And here we are. Here we are, Tim. We're at the point in the show where I usually like to irritate you or prove my point.
Okay.
All right. This is usually the point when zombie apocalypse story or AI stories pop up.
Right.
But I'm telling you, man, we are getting closer and closer to the third alternative.
The monkey,
what's my proof?
The monkey apocalypse?
Monkey apocalypse, I like to call it.
Monkey apocalypse. Okay.
How do I come upon that this week, Tim? Well, this is a new scientific report. How do you like this? Scientists grow bigger monkey brains using human genes, replicating evolution.
Really?
Yeah. Soak it in, Tim. It's our larger brains that set us apart from other primates. Back when we evolved from non-human primates, one specific gene came into play, which made our brains bigger, while theirs stayed smaller. Now, a collaboration between researchers in Germany at the Max Planck Institute of Molecular Cell Biology and Genetics and in Japan at the Central Institute for Experimental Animals have used the same gene to grow a monkey brain bigger. For the first time, their study was published in Science on Thursday. The study is not only incredible, it's also enlightening. It could replicate all the movement and evolution where humans became separate from other primates, all due to one gene, Tim. Are you seeing the rise of monkeypocalypse now is maybe becoming even more clear?
I'll tell you what I'm seeing when you get done with this.
Okay. We had certain hopes what the gene ideally could do and should if it had that function that we postulated it should have, lead study author Wieland Huttner of the Max Planck Institute told Inverse. The very satisfying answer is that the gene did exactly everything that you could have hoped for. The results can be broken down into four sections by inserting the gene. The size of the monkey's neocortex increased. Folding of the brain, similar to how a human brain is folded, was induced. A relevant progenitor of cell type, which produces neurons, was increased. Specifically, it increased upper layer neurons, which are the neurons that increase during evolution. This shows basically that the gene and its expression in humans is sufficient to expand and fold the primate or the monkey brain, co-author of the study Michael Hyde said. As in natural, when working on and with animals, ethical questions arise. Researchers have to ensure that all people working on the project are in line with their ethical thinking and reasoning. The fetus samples for the study came from Japan, and after traveling there for Germany, setting up the experiment and growing the fetuses, the Max Planck Institute team brought them home to Germany. That's all we need is angry German monkeys, Tim.
They run efficiently, though.
Oh, my God, with big human brains? These guys we trust, period, Huttner explained. This is crucial in order to maintain ethical boundaries. After about 100 days after the fetus had been growing, the international team unanimously agreed to remove the fetus through C-section, bringing a new human gene-influenced monkey into the world. Would step over the line, said Huttner. To let them come to be born, in my opinion, would have been irresponsible as a first step, Huttner mentioned, because you don't know what kind of behavioral change you'll get. Here's my thoughts, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
If they figured this out and they know it's happened, both of these countries are going to grow monkey-brained monsters because they're going to treat them as military experiments. They're going to train these monkeys to kill humans, Tim. They may be, I'll tell you this, the monkeys may be our last line of defense against Skynet.
Dave, I'm going to go one step further. They grow those monkey brains, Dave, but they transplant those monkey brains into robotic bodies that are indestructible and then use them against us. A brainiac, Dave, a real-life brainiac that no Superman can take out, Dave. Therefore, best of both worlds in that monkeypocalypse.
Best of both worlds in whose opinion?
Mine. Therefore, the Twinkies are mine.
Oh, my God, no. No, dude, if it's monkeypocalypse, we both lose. That's all I'm going to say.
No,
last week we had monkeys killing, biting 250 people and attacking them. We had AI wombats that were brutally attacking one person after another in a Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees type manner. And now we've got the fact that humanity has played God yet again, and they have created a bigger, better monkey brain, Tim. It's the end of the world as we know it. This is things that shouldn't happen, Tim.
Yeah, I agree. Yep.
All right, my friend, that's it for this week. We've crossed enough stories off our list. We hope you enjoyed today's episode as much as we enjoyed bringing it to you. We will be back Tuesday with more of the best in true crime talk radio, and next weekend with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. For that guy, I'm this guy, and you've been listening to that show. This is Darkness Radio.